أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Okay, the general topic, I guess, is that we're looking to find Isa in history, at least the Isa that we know in Quran and that Allah has told us about. Is that closer or closer? Get it right here. And something like 5 years of research as a Muslim looking at it, and something like 10 as a Muslim as a Christian looking at it has revealed some really interesting things. I have tentatively, you know, named the lecture, the entire series, which is going to be something like 12. I'd originally thought about doing 6 lectures, 2 hours at a time, but because most of this information is historical, it has names that people have never heard of, it has ideas and definitions are necessary for concepts that are not easily understood for somebody who is sophomoric in their knowledge about history, specifically first century, you know, Christian history. I decided to break it up so we'd do 1 hour at a time. So we'll end up having something like 12 lectures or so. I've titled it From Isa to Islam, A Historical Journey, because I think that's exactly what we find in the study of the history of religion, is that we find the same concepts that exist inside of Islam reemergent over and over and over again with these messengers who come who are speaking basically the same message that we're finding, you know, our messenger, you know, speak about in history. And between the time of Isa and our messenger, we realize that that span of time, as there's a tremendous amount of corruption, something takes place because the messenger comes on the scene and Allah begins to tell us things that are historical. He talks about people that are not necessarily around anymore. Isa, of course, is no longer around. His followers are no longer around anymore. And because Allah has made historical claims, as well as He has made scientific claims, the same way that we have looked at science has eventually revealed the truth of Allah's statement to show it as to be a miracle, so in the study of history, we have found that the historical statements that Allah has said concerning His messengers, you know, before Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, are also true, and to me they seem to be a miracle also. Inshallah, other Muslims will also. The concept here is we're going to build a pyramid over the next 12 sessions or so, starting with a very general idea of how we're going to talk about this discussion, and we're going to start with an analogy and then move forward. You okay, brother? During the first part of 1997, a group of young adults walked into a specialty store and bought an expensive Empower telescope to look at a comet that was not yet visible with the naked eye. A few days later, they returned the telescope and asked for their money back because the telescope was broken. When asked how it was broken by the manager, the group said that the telescope did not show the spaceship that was following it. The manager of the store tried to convince them that it was not broken and there was no spaceship following the comet, but they would not change their mind. This group, of course, was called the Heaven's Gate, founded by Marshall Applewhite. On March 26, 1997, 39 members of this group were found dead after having committed suicide in order for their souls to be able to meet the spaceship that was following Hellbob. They believed that the spaceship would take them to a new incarnation. What's really interesting about this happening, and I'm going to show how there's a parallel with the history of Christianity, is that these group of people who believed this weren't uneducated people. And Applegate was a former professor. Many of the followers of Applegate, you know, had master's degrees, and a number of them had PhDs. They were highly educated. A lot of them were computer programmers, made a tremendous amount of money, doing programs and setting up websites and so forth. They were very educated, and they weren't poor. This wasn't a group of radicals who didn't have any money. They were wealthy, lived in a very wealthy area of Southern California. And there are two very important things about this, you know, before we laugh at them, is that, like Christianity, they had a belief about religion. And they had a belief that seemed to have physical evidence that confirmed something of their faith, the comet. Which means that though they had a belief about a religion, the fact that they had some type of physical symbol, something that was tangible, allowed them to try to express this belief and say, all of what I believe is correct. There's, of course, a problem with this, is that the physical confirmation did not confirm the entirety of the faith. Other evidence and experts disagreed with the presupposition, which is really interesting because even in the beginning of their particular movement, family members and other former professors who knew Applegate and knew these students would argue with them, as well as the manager of this particular store who I believe has an advanced degree in astronomy, who knew about this particular comet and tried to argue with them, yet they rejected it. The thesis question to this, that we're talking about this, and I'll show how this is clear, is a question. What causes and sustains this type of mentality? Because this is at the root of religion that exists outside of Islam. This idea that because we have a historical reality, that it justifies our beliefs. And I've defined historical reality in four ways. Number one is that there is a historical reality in people. Others believe, and the founder was trustworthy. Applegate understood his particular religion. He had an idea, he had a complete system of beliefs, and he had literature. And other believers begin to see Applegate as somebody who was an expert, and therefore they should believe him because he's an expert about this particular faith, and he has some knowledge about science. So it seems to have some type of credibility that this religion predates the believers who were there. In the same way that I converted to Islam, and there are people who were more knowledgeable than me, there is two ways for me to view this person. Either I reject what they say, or I see them as a historical reality that this religion must have some trustworthiness because it exists before me. The other thing is that there's a historical place that they know that there is a physical reality of this comet, that it's physical, it's tangible, and they can test this. They could see it, and this is why they bought this telescope. And not only that, but the events themselves were calculable. They knew when the comet was coming. They knew when it had come before. And not only that, like I said before, that they had religious texts. Other believers had published texts teaching about this theology of Applegate's. The reason for their particular desire to reject this was because of an idea I'm going to talk about, which is called cognitive dissonance. And that is the feeling of extreme discomfort, originally defined as being caused by holding two or more inconsistent cognitions, and subsequently defined as being caused by performing an action that is discrepant from one's customary, typical, positive self-concept. That's a scientific way of talking about this. Let me talk about it in a more general way. Is that the Heaven's Gate member had two ideas about themselves. They were first educated people. They were people who believed that they could understand the world through science, through knowledge, through history. They were educated. Many of them were upper middle class. They were the high standing of, you know, at least of the state. And number two, that they were believers in this. And the problem with these two things is that there is eventually going to be a discrepancy between their historical reality of their faith, of what they believe is true, and with their education that's causing them to have to do something about this, because they can't have both. You can't, in this particular faith, be an extremely educated, scientifically minded person and have these beliefs. Because they realize that the dissonance is taking place, this uncomfortable feeling inside, because they're educated and they should be rational, but at the same time, because they're believers in this, they must be faithful. So there's only three alternatives for these three groups of people. One is to change the position that's causing this discrepancy, which means they either reject knowledge and they say, I believe because I believe, because I'm having some feeling, or they can justify their behavior by changing one of their cognitions, or they can attempt to justify it. An example with smoking, what I'm talking about, make this easier. Let's say that you have a smoker and he sees himself as a logical, happy person, and he's reasonable. And then he sees a sign that says smoking causes cancer. Because he's a logical person and believes he's a good person, that sign is causing him to feel uncomfortable, because he realizes that seeing that this causes cancer goes against the fact that he's a reasonable person. He wouldn't go against this because he wouldn't do something that was going to cause him harm, because he feels himself to be logical and a good person. This is something that people who are not good do. So he has a choice here. He can stop smoking. That way he can stop this feeling inside. Number two, he can change one of his cognitions, which means I'm reasonable, but not every smoker gets cancer. So he changes one of them, one of his positions. Well, yeah, I believe that, but not everybody gets cancer. That way I can get rid of this idea by saying I've thought this through. I'm being logical because I know the statistics. I could be one of the few who don't get it. Number two, he can justify by saying he gets some benefit from it. It relaxes me. And he can justify it. You know, the Heaven's Gate shopper chose to justify their beliefs. they chose to say, I believe in science and this religion, but this piece of scientific equipment is broken. They tried to justify it. Therefore, they can maintain their faith in Applegate and their education. They don't come into conflict with each other. The history of Christianity is a history of cognitive dissonance. I don't mean the history of Christianity in the sense of the last 100 years or the last 200 years, because after about the 5th century, 6th century, there is no more Christianity anymore. It ends because we have the messenger who's going to come. But before that, you have a lot of cognitive dissonance. You have persons who are struggling with how to define their faith. And that's because they have a historical reality, like I said before. They have historical realities of people that were real historical figures. You have Jesus and John and Paul, the Romans and the Jews. Those are real people. We can't deny that. Number two, they have real places. Israel, the Jordan River, parts of Palestine. They have Sinai. They have all these places in the Middle East that are real, tangible places. They are historical realities. And they have real events that they can look into history books and find real events. They have the Romans conquering Israel. They have the Jewish revolts. They have the rise of Hellenism in that area. And they have texts by which they can find this material. Real texts. The New Testament, the Old Testament. They have the pseudepigrapha and all these different documents by which they can justify their faith. So when we look at Christianity today, you're talking with a person who, like the Heaven's Gates persons, have a tremendous amount of material by which to justify their faith. And for you to try to come against it and attack it, you're attacking all of this information that they can lean their faith up against and say, I believe because of all these historical realities that are around me. But there's a problem. The historical reality of Christianity does not prove the entirety of their faith or their doctrines and theologies. And what I mean by that, it is true that when Christians say there was a real Isa, we know that, historical reality. There were these people called the Romans. There were these people called the Jews, the Pharisees, the Sadducees. There were these councils. All of those things are real. There was Paul, and there was persecution of Christians and all these things. That's true. Those are historical realities of Christianity that you can't deny. There were theologies, for instance, that existed at that time that are realities. But the problem is that the entirety of their faith, what they have today, when you're trying to weigh that against the historical realities that they have, including their text, those things are not supported. And what I mean is like the idea of the Trinity. It is a reality that the Trinity exists at some period of time, and it is now part of the Christian faith. To try to argue with the Christian that the Trinity isn't part of their faith, well, that's ridiculous. It is. And the texts themselves have been developed specifically to uphold that. You can't argue with them and say that they don't believe that that for them, the Messiah was going to die and that by his death, he would take on the sins of the world upon him. So all you can do, you have like a license to sin. You know, you sin, you can put up your card to Allah and say, you know, it's okay. You know, Jesus already paid for this, you know, crime. Therefore, I'm okay. You know, I repent and you can move on. That is a reality in the religion, but it does not exist as a historical reality or as a historical proof for them if they're trying to associate all of these historical realities with Isa. Isa exists outside of that. It's the same, for instance, if I was going to talk about us in this room if 300 years from now. I could talk about the historical reality. There were Muslims in this room. There were people who lived here at this time. They believed in the Quran. They made prayer, right? And they used to have this crucifix that was up here, and they used to bow down to the crucifix and make the sign of the cross and so forth. Now, everything that's around this other historical realities is true, but the particular statement about the cross and the theology that goes along with that, that's not supported by it. And the history of Christianity is exactly this way. The old other texts and scholars disagree with the Christian idea. From the rise of Paul's faith until recently, major scholars like John Crossan, Jews and scholars have disagreed with the Christians from the very beginning. And that's something that people don't understand, is that the texts themselves, the Bible, doesn't come out of heaven, you know, opened up, like, and it comes out like, oh, and it falls, and all of a sudden the Christians have it. They don't exist like that. Each one emerges as a historical document because of a particular happening. And each one of them emerged because of what we talked about before, cognitive dissonance. A social cognitive dissonance that societies of persons who called themselves Christians at different periods of time were experiencing social persecution, political, economic persecution problems that caused them to have to reformulate their faith. So there is a discrepancy in the idea that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which are the supposed Injils of Jesus, are in any way part of the Injil of Jesus. They aren't, because each one is written at a different period of time to reformulate the historical Jesus, to make a new one that fits better in the society. They don't contradict each other. There's an evolution. I mean, the Christian is correct in interpreting his text the way he's interpreting it, but that has nothing to do with Isa. And that's what I think a lot of scholars who are doing or involved in this don't understand. It does support their faith. Those books do say that Isa is God. It does. In other texts, it doesn't clearly state it. Later on, it does. There is a verse in the Bible, for instance, says that Jesus, who being in very nature God, made himself nothing in the form of man. It does say that. And what we try to do is get in this debate of trying to find where there's the contradictions. Well, the religion is built on contradictions. It is what it is. It is a faith of contradictions. We're going to talk about historical, cognitive dissonances. That is that justification and the reinvention of Jesus is the faith of Christianity. The Gospels were rewritten because of particular historical challenges to its faith. Like I said before, both political, theological, and historical. And in the next number of lectures, we're going to talk about each one of those and what happens with the faith. Because when we begin to look at them as historical happenings, the development of this literature, what we find is the movement of Isa going one way, and the religion of Paul and the Christians going the exact opposite way. And what's most fascinating about this is that when we use the Quran and the Hadith as the basis by which we judge who was on the path of Isa and who was not, we find that the Christian movement has absolutely nothing to do with the movement of Isa. As a matter of fact, historically, when we look at historical documents concerning this, we only find support for Quran and Hadith. We don't find them removed. Each gospel in the reality or cognition of the Christian faith but each rewritten gospel is the new reality or cognition of the Christian faith. We don't have this concept, this idea that now we're in a new time, so we need to write a new story about the messenger. We don't have that idea. But we impose our particular realities about our religion on other populations. Right, it's wrong, it seems silly, but Christians have done that. And what I mean is that for each new generation, a new Jesus has emerged symbolically. And it's clearly seen in the development of the gospel text, because each Jesus becomes new. Each Isa is brand new. We don't have that in the religion. And I believe that our religion is developed specifically to deal with that problem, to remove it. Because even Allah tells us throughout the Quran that it was by their own hand that they begin to write. It was the fact that they begin to look at their own priests and their rabbis, and they begin to worship them. How? Because they're making a reinvention, a new Jesus for each generation. And each reinvention of this new Jesus moves them further and further away from the historical Jesus, the historical Isa, which only exists in one place, in Quran and Hadith. It doesn't exist inside of the Christian scriptures. The entire faith of Christianity is built on justification. Each level of Christianity from each century, we can see that. We see it in words like schisms and revolts and councils. And I think that's something that Muslims are amiss when they're beginning to look at Christianity, is that if you look closely at Christianity, Christianity does a wonderful job of covering over its own movement, its own evolution away from the original faith, and at the same time covers up over those persons who are trying to get away from that reinvention of Jesus, of rewriting him. And they do that by classifying persons who rebelled against this changing idea of Jesus, who he was, by classifying them as persons who are involved in schisms, or they're involved in sects, S-E-C-T-S. And this is done in councils. The Council of Nicaea, the Council of Chalcedon. This is where you have a minority group of Christian scholars who are telling the majority how they're going to believe, not only about Isa, but about salvation, about Allah, and these things. They are conscious that it's moving away from the historical reality of what really happened during the time of Isa. There's bloody fights that take place in history. We're going to talk about them between persons who are trying to stop this inside of the Christian faith, who are even though that they've evolved away from the religion of Isa, many times in these, quote, schisms, the Catholic Church calls them, These are groups of people who are rebelling, trying to go back to the original religion. In the same sense that you find somebody like Muhammad Wahhab, who is trying to take the Muslims who are moving away from their faith and turn them back to the originals of their faith. Now, we can see that as one of two things. We can see this as somebody who's trying to reform it. He becomes a reformer. Or we can see that person as who's involved in a schism, trying to take us back to something primitive. When in reality, what Isa is talking about historically is much more full. It's full of justice and integrity and an idea that is closer to Islam than any other religion. What takes place in Christianity by the time we get to the 5th and 6th century is going to look much more like the Persian religions and the religions of Mesopotamia than anything else. And we're going to look at that also and watch how that happens. What do I believe about Islam's place in this? Is that, like I said before, we're the holders of the truth of the religion. That Allah says things that are historical that we can test. That we can go back into history and we find them to be true. It doesn't mean that because I don't find something that's historical about what Allah says, or I can't prove it, that I reject it. Because I know it's true. I'm just waiting for the evidence to come. But the fact that there is evidence about certain things that Allah says, especially about the Christians, or the followers of Isa, I should say better, I can test those and we can find them. What's interesting about this testing is that most of this wasn't known 30 or 40 years ago. You know, recently me and Khalid, the imam from Ming, were looking at, you know, the unabridged Ibn Kathir and looking at early commentaries, trying to find out what early scholars in Islam had said concerning these people, the Sabians, the Nasara. Who are these people? And where are they? Because they are historical people. They're being talked about. And for the most part, the scholars, as we look at them, there is confusion about them. There's a disagreement about who they are. You know, even the earliest, when we were looking in the Arabic at the earliest narrations concerning them, no one's quite sure who they are. And there's a reason for that. No one knows quite sure who they are, because Christians did a wonderful job of obliterating them. And we can see that historically when that takes place. And the fact that Allah is talking about them by name, names that hadn't been in circulation for hundreds of years before the messenger comes, to me is astounding when it takes place. I was asked a couple of times by some Muslims who were local about how I felt about saying things that other earlier scholars hadn't said about Isa, and I have to reply that if they had this information, they would use it. Because I've heard stories, for instance, about some of the great imams who would give a hadith, and when they heard something that contradicted these hadiths, is this right, Imam Malik, is that who heard another hadith and then said, you know, forget what I've said, you know, that's the... So in that sense, I think that if you have a reality, a truth, that any scholar in their right mind, who's on the right path, even 10 years ago, if they had this information, which they didn't, they would have said the same thing. And the problem is that Muslims for 1400 years have tried to talk about Christianity with a text that was written for the purpose to cover up the truth about Isa and the development of that religion. I mean, I have said that that what you're looking at when you look at the New Testament is similar to, if you're debating about it, let's say we had a book of hadith that were all fabricated in it, and you had somebody who says, I believe in these fabrications, right? And then the Muslim to come and knowing that these are fabricated, and then opening it up and trying to find contradictions in it. Oh, this one contradicts that one, and that one contradicts this one, but here's some truth in this one right here. You see that? That proves Islam, but it's irrelevant. It's a book full of lies that were never written to represent the reality, the historical reality of what the messenger said. It doesn't represent it. It doesn't represent that. And that's what I think Muslims have missed for 1400 years. I know it's a big statement, but it's true. And I've spent the last 5 years, I mean, knocking my head over this, why they're doing this, because they didn't know. And there's a reason why they didn't know. They didn't know because most of the recent archaeological discoveries have taken place in the last 40 years, last 50 years. And the fact of the matter is that Muslims have not been engaged in recent archaeological discoveries, even when those discoveries take place in their very lands. We don't have the languages, we don't have the historical ability, we don't have the archaeological ability. So when they're discovered there, for instance, primary is a group of scrolls called the Nag Hammadi collection that was found in Egypt, was found by a Muslim man, a Muslim boy actually, who was looking for like dried camel dung or dried pieces of things in the sand so that they could build a fire with. And they open, he kicks around some sand. True story. Here are all these pots, these old clay pots. He opens it up. It's full of these things that look like old wood. It's scrolls, some of the oldest scrolls in the world ever discovered, you know, concerning Christianity. He takes them home and his mother starts throwing them in the fire to feed the fire so she can make bread. It's possible that the Injil, I mean, Allahu Alam, the Injil could have been burned in there, the writings of Isa. And what we have inside of that collection is a historical collection of books, I mean, of manuscripts that trace the evolution of Christian theology, the oldest being the Gospel of Thomas. I'm not saying the Gospel of Thomas can be validated. It's because the Gospel of Thomas is structured in a way that you don't have narration, in the sense that you don't have stories like, and Jesus was walking along the river, and while he was on the river, he said, and then quote. It's absent of that, and all you have is, and Isa said, and Isa said, and Isa said, and these sayings. And what's really startling about this is that they are in the same form as the hadith of our messenger, how we've collected them. The same way, they're collected. Now the problem is that though there are sayings in there that are obviously not at the time of Isa, there are things, not that are in there, but that are not in there, that are very important. In this document, there is no discussion of the Trinity, no idea of the Eucharist, or the idea of eating the body of Isa and drinking his blood, you know, as part of purification. You don't have that. You don't have the idea about the divinity of Mary. You don't have the idea about a crucifixion, or that Isa is going to die and salvation is going to come by this. You have none of that there. Instead, you have Isa talking about the kingdom of God that's going to be both inside of you and outside of you. What's really interesting is when we look at the language, the Coptic language, he's talking about twofold, you know, submission of the self and submission of the land. A physical submission of the body and the physical submission of the land to the laws that he wants to uphold in the area. That's startling. The only problem is that they're, unlike hadith, where we have a clear science of the transmission of isnad, we can judge them. It doesn't exist inside of these texts, so we can't validate them in the same sense we can with hadith. But we can look at them as a historical document by which we can trace the movement of Christian theology and even maybe reconstruct it as a whole in the first century. Yeah, I feel like there's a great obligation, I think, to Muslims to dispel the lies about Isa, because up until now, the reality is, whether Muslims like it or not, the best scholars in Christianity are Christians. The best scholars about Isa and about his time period are not Muslims, they're Christians. And what I find really interesting about this is that one of these, who happens to be a Jew, his name is Robert Eisenman, who teaches at Columbia, has this startling statement at the beginning of his book. Big, bold letters. He says, I can't quote him directly, he says, "It is amazing to me that Muslims weren't the first to pick up these documents and use them, because it supports the religion of their messenger, Muhammad." That's by a Jew who's saying that, who's an atheist, who doesn't believe in Islam, but is looking at modern discovery and saying, where are the Muslims at? Well, we know what happened with the Muslims. They have put their head in a hole, and they've decided to utilize the gospel text as a historical reality, painting the true reality of the people who existed inside these texts, and they don't. And that's unfortunate, because we're still looking at Bible contradictions rather than looking at history and archaeology. When we find Isa in history, we find not only a Muslim on the straight path of his religion, we find a man who was like our messenger, Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He is a man. When we look at history, we don't find a man who is talking about being God. We find a man who is angry at Roman occupation. The Romans who want to Hellenize, or the better word today would be modernize, the religion, because it doesn't coincide with the religion of the Romans. The Romans who say, you know what, Yahweh, your God, we know he's intangible, and you worship the Creator, and you worship the God of Abraham, but listen, Zeus is also our Creator. He's also the big God. So therefore, Zeus is going to be Yahweh. Yahweh is going to be Zeus. That way we can all just get along. We'll have the consolidation of religions. And the most radical of the Jews, and I wouldn't say, let me not say the most radical, the Jews who knew stood against it. And the Jews who were afraid of the oppression of the Romans compensated these Jews who stood on the straight path by betraying them and allowing them to be executed and siding with the Romans, and thousands, and I mean thousands, of the followers of Isa, which we know historically they're called the Nazarites, the Nasara, the Nazarenes, are slaughtered and betrayed by the rabbinical Jews who just want to get along, are betrayed by them in 60, and then in 120, and then finally in 160. And we'll talk about them in three. Next week we'll start. Let me tell you how we're not going to engage Christianity as an idea. I'm not going to engage it as a religion because it's irrelevant to me whether or not the Christian today worships a man they called Isa. That to me is irrelevant because it's not the Isa that is talked about in Quran, and it's not the Isa that Jesus was. This is a religion that is completely separate from the movement of Isa and his followers. It has nothing to do with it. This religion develops starting in the 5th century and then completely moves away. The last of the Nasara, the last of the Nazarite and the Jews who are on the straight path, they become Muslim as soon as the messenger comes. And
so are Nazareans and Unitarian Christians, are these terms interchangeable?
No, they're not, because Unitarians also are a group of people, and we'll talk about this, I think, in the third lecture, are descendants of a movement called the Arians that are basically obliterated. By the 4th century, they don't even exist anymore as a political movement. And again, what we find with Unitarians is breakoff groups, which Christians call schisms, or groups of people who see that what they believe about in their Bible does not coincide with the historical reality of Isa, and therefore they've tried to revolt against it and have been squashed by, you know, those who were in political power at that time, who are going to be the descendants of the Roman religion, which we're going to find that there's a separation between Paul's movement, which is nice and safe inside of Rome, while the movement of Isa, who were the Nasara, the Nazarenes, they're involved in a jihad against the Romans, and they win. They win because they set up a Jewish state founded on Torah, and reject the compromising Jews, and they stand for decades before their own people. I don't want to give too much away. We'll talk about that.
But we notice in the Quran that Allah Ta'ala speaks in a condemnatory fashion about an-Nasara. So
yes.
He's just using the word also for the descendants 5 centuries later who had thoroughly corrupted the religion.
Yes, because after they win the state, there's a power vacuum that takes place. And the same way that after the jihad inside of Afghanistan, the minute that they finish fighting the Russians, they're fighting each other for who's going to be in political control. That's what happens. And I believe that the primary reason for that takes place, and this is only my opinion, is because the two main leaders are not around. First, Isa isn't around. And the second, the person who was the next in charge of the Nasara, who is James, actually his name in Hebrew, that's a corruption of the name. His name is Yaqub. They call him Yaqub I don't want to say that yet because that's going to give away too much too. They call him Yaqub. He is executed by the Jews, the Hellenized Jews. They execute him by throwing him off of the temple because he won't basically bow a knee to Rome. He refuses to pay taxes. He's a Muslim. And if you want to find a Muslim like him, you're going to have to go to the times of jihad and find somebody who is both upholding his religion, who's pious, and who's fighting an occupier. That's where you're going to have to look to find somebody like Isa or Yaqub. Anyways... I'm not going to be involved in Bible contradictions. I mean, it's already understood. Like I said before, it's like a book of fabrications. I'm not going to get involved with trying to prove to somebody that, for instance, the collection of hadith by the Shia, that most of these right here, if not all of them, are a bunch of lies because they propagate an idea that is absolutely contrary to Islam. I don't have time for this. I'm not going to go through each one. I could just say that you're on the wrong path. If you want to find the message of Islam, you can't go and try to find a movement that develops out of rebellion. You're going to have to look earlier than that and find the first generations. You have to look at the beginning of Islam to find Islam. In the same way with the Christians, I'm not going to be involved in going through each one of their entire Bibles to find contradictions when the entire book is a contradiction. And if it contains thousands of verses, I don't have any time for this. You need to reject it as a whole and say it has nothing to do with Isa. You can see this clearly, like if you look at the red letter edition of like the New Testament, where you have all of the words of Isa in their New Testament in red. So you can see here's the teachings of Isa, which is equivalent to our hadith. That's how we'll have to look at it. The only difference between what the gospel has and the hadith is you have somebody who's editing it for very political reasons, and we're going to see that later, where they're going through because some hadith are pretty radical. So you have somebody who comes later who takes the hadith, opens it up, and starts to make stories around it. Stories that make the addition of these hadith invalidate the principles by which they were originally told, were given to uphold. Let me give you an example of that in the New Testament. New Testament, there is something called the Beatitudes. And I think everyone's heard them. It says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are these." And this is really interesting because the way it comes out in the Gospels out of the mouth of Isa is that Isa is saying this to a bunch of passive religion, that the religion is for the poor, it's for the person who's, you know, doesn't wash his face or something, who's always slouching over, you know, the poor guy, right? But that's not what happened, because what you have is a group of Christians who are coming later and playing on the words. The words meek and poor inside of the Aramaic language isn't translated that. It's translated Nasara, or it can even be translated as Ebionites. Or it can be, we'll talk about it next time. It's translated Nasara. He's talking about the Ebionites. And the Ebionites show up in the Quran, though it's not under the name Ebionites or Nasara. It shows up as another name that scholars are kind of confused on. But when we look at how the Christians have changed the words, we find two groups of people. The Nasara, who are the followers of Isa, and another group, the Sabians, who are going to have the same root and are going to split in some ways. We'll talk about it later. Another thing is that I'm not going to, how we're not going to engage Christianity is not with debating about does their book support their faith. Their book does support their faith. It does, because their faith is based on contradictions and re-editing and cognitive dissonance, like we talk about, and that's what that book is full of. It's built that way. They know it's that way because when you look at the history of the development of their theology isn't settled until like the 1500s, before you have the settlement of how is salvation. As a matter of fact, the idea of deifying Isa, which is to believe that Isa is Allah, doesn't happen until the 4th century, and that doesn't take place except by warfare. And in the same way that Muslims are sometimes angry, like the brothers talking a little earlier, who open up the text and begin to read and say, aha, here it is. You said that you can kill Christians and Jews. That must be each individual Christian and Jews. You guys are a bunch of terrorists. In the same way, what Muslims are not doing is recognizing that the New Testament also has a translation that allows abrogation and different ideas inside of it that allow for the contradictions. Now, granted, this book has nothing to do with the religion of Isa, like I've said over and over and over again. But nevertheless, it is part of their faith. It's what they believe. The best thing that can take place between the Christian and the Muslim is for the Christian to understand that if he has a desire to love Isa and to find him and be on the way of Isa, he has to come to Islam, because we have the truth concerning that. How we're going to engage in this topic as we begin to move on is, first of all, to realize that cognitive dissonance will cause them to justify their faith. First of all, no matter what you say to them, if they have come to argue with you, they didn't come to concede anything. I remember about 4 years ago when we went, me and another brother went to a Bible college and seminary in Portland, Oregon, and they invited us to dialogue or debate about Islam. They didn't invite us there because they wanted to hear truth. They wanted to invite us there to argue, which for me is a waste of my time if I spend a tremendous amount of time preparing myself to answer them when they didn't come to hear what I had to say about their religion or about Islam. They came only to fight. So I have an advice for persons who are involved in dawah, in this sense, in debating. Save your breath. It's not worth it. You know, you can't guide them. Only Allah can guide them. And if they haven't come to hear but the debate, they didn't come to hear at all. And I'm not going to be involved in that. If there are persons who want to do that, have long drawn out dialogues with people to see if they come around, that's fine. I'm not interested in it. How to engage Christianity. First of all, it's necessary for us to rescue Isa from the rewriting of the Christians of their text through the use of history. I don't have to go to their text to find Isa. I can use historical documents that exist at that time. And what I mean by that is this, is that if we're looking for the historical reality of Isa, what we have to do is we have to reconstruct his historical environment. what was going on at that time. For instance, there'd be no way for somebody to talk about the first millennium of the world, I mean the second millennium of the world, without talking about the fight between the West and between those who have engaged the West. You know, for instance, you couldn't talk about it without talking about the World Trade Center. You couldn't talk about this century without talking about Afghanistan or Iraq or the war of the West against Islam. You couldn't talk about those. You couldn't talk about history without talking about those things. In the same way, when we look at the first century, there are things that you cannot exclude if you're going to talk about that period. Primarily, is the books that are written at that time. You know, Christians and Muslims have this idea that the only things that they can look at that time is the Gospels. Like somehow writing begins at that time. And the reality is that the group of people who lived at that time, the Christians, most of them were the most uneducated population of people that this planet has never known. There was no middle class. You were either part of the merchant, you know, elite, or part of the aristocracy, or you were impoverished and you spoke an impoverished language, Aramaic. One or the other. And you have to talk about that, the social classes that exist at that time, if you want to talk about this. Not only that, but you have to talk about the archaeology at that time. You have to talk about who was there, how long were there, where were their buildings at, what were these symbols for, what were these statues for, because all of that, it sheds light on what's taking place during this time. You have to talk about historical sociology. What was the social structure of the people at that time? For instance, you couldn't talk about Islam you know, during the time of the messenger and then talk about how people used to walk around and hug the women, you know, Muslims would hug the women, hey, how are you doing, picking up on them, going out on dates. That's not a historical reality that took place during the first generations. You can't say it. You have to talk about the historical reality of how people dealt with each other. For instance, let me give you an example, is this idea of Isa in the Gospels being able to, he walks wherever he wants. He's just kind of casually walking, he's talking, he's sitting down, he's having these long lectures about, you know, peace and freedom and giving you're given to Caesar what is Caesar's, given to God what is God's. That's absurd. The Messianism, or the desire to remove Greek philosophy and to remove the Romans from occupation, had been going on for decades. And the Romans were in the habit of executing by crucifixion by the thousands. They would line their roads with this. There was it was an ugly time. There were assassins, the Sicarii at this time, who were Jews, who if you were pro-Roman, they would cut your neck. They weren't going to shake your hands and say, let's talk about your theology. What do you believe? Let's go have some coffee. Hey, we'll agree to disagree. No, they killed those people who disagreed. And somebody like Isa, as represented in the Gospel text, he wouldn't have made it 2 days spouting off, give unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and give unto God what is God's. He'd have been executed not only by the most radical, the Sicarii, but he would have been executed by his own community, because the Gospels themselves at least get one thing right. He was a Nazarite. Not from Nazareth. He was a Nazarite. He was a person who, I mean, we would translate that Islam. He was submitted to the Torah. He was submitted to the laws of Moses. No one in their right mind who basically went to the wilderness, like Yahya and the rest of his group, to prepare themselves both spiritually and physically for jihad against the Romans, would sit around and talking about give taxes to Rome. It would have been an oxymoron. It's an impossibility. Can't do it. So we have to talk about historical sociology. What was taking place at that time? How was historical structure? Number four is the literature of the time. You've got to know the literature of the time, because the Gospels are not the only text. The Romans did an extensive amount of writing. They kept records of not only of political happenings around their world, but they also kept literature and poetry and philosophy and dialogues and debates and letters and just a whole slew of information. And by taking that information and comparing with all these other things, we begin to develop a historical reality. But the foundation of that, if we base it on Quran and Hadith, what we find is that as we develop this historical reality of the time of Isa, we begin to find that what Allah is saying is a miracle, because it begins to reconstruct something that no one knew for hundreds of years before the messenger, and not until 50 years ago. That's a miracle, I think. Well, let me tell you what my purpose is not. My purpose is not to prove the Christian wrong. They're fully capable of doing that themselves. I don't have to engage in that, right? It's not up to me to show them that they contradict themselves. They're very aware that they do it. And that's why they continue to justify themselves. The minute that they say, but, it's all over. They're engaged in a form of justification that this is irrelevant. And not only that, but they have the book to do that. Because their book, they have a book that basically in one section talks about monotheism, and the next talks about Isa being Allah. And that's how you begin to get the derivative from those two things. You get the Trinity. Why? Because you have the reconciliation of these things that don't make sense together. How can you have monotheism, and how can you have over here the idea that Isa is Allah? Well, what they do is they formulate between the two. Well, they're the same person. Must be three in one. And the entire doctrine of that, I know I'm belittling it, but we'll get into it extensively. The entire of their doctrine, their theologies, are based on the same thing, taking contradictions. A contradiction of Judaism with the Hellenized religions, they have nothing to do with each other. Nothing. But they come together and they make Christianity. Christianity is the mixing of two. Yes,
I think this is the classical explanation of this historically, that this is called a divine mystery. How the Trinity and monotheism come together, and this is how they escape explanation of what is inconsistent with reality and rationality.
Yes. I think that that's not. I think they begin to do that because they were killing each other over this, and we're going to talk about that in great length. And I think that lecture will be called "When Jesus Became God." I picked up a number of books on it, and I'm reading one right now. It's really interesting and stimulating. Is that they were fighting about this? The Christians didn't have it resolved. And just to give you kind of a bird's eye view, we're going to talk about is because up until Constantine, they were a persecuted religion. They practiced their religion in holes, literally in catacombs, in tombs. They had to practice their religion. There was no real dialogue between any of them. So when they emerge as the majority, and when they emerge as the power, you have all these different views of coming out. These different bishops are saying, this is what we believe about Isa. And you have this other one coming out of a hole for, you know, the last 3 years, says, that's not possible. Our scholars say such and such. Our scholars say such and such. You have a war to see who's going to win, and the person who decides this isn't the most pious Christian or the most knowledgeable person. It's going to be a emperor who doesn't care either way. He just wants. Yeah, we're talking about. Well, that's one of them. Nicaea. It's an emperor who's not a Christian.
Pagan king.
Yes, he's going to decide it for them because he doesn't want his kingdom to fall apart because they've been through political strife for literally 100 years. He doesn't want to go through this again. So he wants to unify it. And number two, it's the population, the mobs of people who are going to decide it, because they're going to begin to kill the most knowledgeable people about this and eliminate them from dialoguing about this. I mean, it's my conviction, if it hadn't been for Constantine, you might have found the reemergence, well, you know, Allahu Alam, the reemergence of monotheism, because it seemed like it was going to go that way, the absolute rejection of Isa as a divine being. It didn't go that way. Spears, swords, and arrows, you know, stop that from happening. The next thing is that their purpose is to show that Isa of the Quran to Muslims in order so that they can see that Allah's book is the only book that paints Isa in the noble light he deserves, and inshallah to give Muslims the tools to engage in dawah to those among the Christian population whom Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has guided to truth. And what I mean by that is this, is that unfortunately Muslims not having this information have resorted to information that is now, you know, expired. I mean, we wouldn't drink milk that has been expired for a week, but yet we're taking something that is much more valuable than this, that can make somebody much sicker. We're talking about truth and eternity, and using something that's been outdated for 50 years. And the Christians know this because, you know, he's somewhat of a friend. He stays in contact with me. A guy I know named who's in Trinity Evangelicals. He's in seminary in Chicago, one of the most, you know, pristine and, you know, highly sought after degree is this Master's Divinity that's there. He said himself, when I begin to approach him and talk to him about this, he goes, I don't know anything about this. I never heard it. I don't know anything about it. It's like a surprise attack. But yet when I went to his previous school, who did the professors confront me with immediately? He says, yeah, I've read, you know, Ahmed Didat. I've read Jamal Bedawi. I've read those guys. He's prepared. He's got his hands rubbing together. He's ready for an attack because he knows this material. But yet this modern material, it's easier to leave it alone. Why? Because Christians themselves are struggling with it. Because how do you reconcile the fact that the historical Jesus has nothing to do with Christianity? So you have the best of the scholars debating. You have books that are coming now about, for instance, the title I just read, which was Why Jesus Must Change, or Why Must Christianity Change, and another one, Rescuing the Historical Jesus. And you have all these books that are coming out recently by Christian scholars who are trying to save their faith because they realize the extent of this material, what it's going to cause.
Like that email I sent you?
Yeah, it's the basic thing.
Then they have 5,000 members.
Yes.
Searching for the historical Jesus.
Yes.
They're trying to obfuscate all this information.
Yes. And last but not least, the life and times of Isa and the Nazarites, or as Allah has called them, the Nasara. It's really interesting because I didn't know this when I read it. It took a Jewish scholar to point it out to me. I hadn't seen it before. When he began to talk about the derivatives of these words, that when we look at the derivatives, we begin to find something in the Quran and during the time of the messenger that we didn't know until recently, and the only way they found it was by recent discoveries. Two that I'm really excited about. One is, of course, the Nag Hammadi library. We'll talk about it, what's good and what's bad about it, and how to use it. And the second is the Qumran documents, the Dead Sea Scrolls. And for a while, the Jews had kept the Dead Sea Scrolls hidden. No one was allowed to see it except for the Jews, even though, you know, it's community property. It was discovered in the area that wasn't, you know, occupied by, you know, anybody at the time. I mean, it should be everybody's. It should be world property. They're historical documents. They should be open.
Now
they're all released because one of these guys that I'm talking about, who is Robert Eisenman, you know, basically forced it to happen.
Are they on the internet?
You can. I have some books. I'll bring, you know, the most pertinent, you know, information on it. One is very interesting, and I'll talk about this, and we'll talk about it later. Two things. One is, it has been wondered how come these particular books haven't been passed down, because there's a lot of them. Well, the number one reason is the owners of these books were annihilated by the Romans. And predominantly they were annihilated because they were betrayed by their own people and rejected by the Christians who originally claimed that they were on the path of Isa. But when Isa and his followers were involved in a type of warfare with the Romans, they began to reinvent an Isa over and over and over again, to the point where they didn't even recognize their own religion and begin to feel bad about it and war over it. We're gonna talk about that. I don't want to give away too much right now. And how much time do we have, brother?
Well, 2 minutes.
I guess we'll conclude here and say, you know, may Allah guide us in a straight path, mm-hmm. not on those who have incurred His wrath or have gone astray, and may Allah expose the falsehood of 2,000 years of Christian lies, and may Allah strengthen us against these lies with iman and taqwa.
So, brother, the next lecture is in 2 weeks, right?
I was going to do it next week.
No, every week.
Next week. Yeah, the next. Inshallah, the next week we're going to talk about.
Just one more time. I might have already asked this, but we hear this word Nasara, and
yeah.
I've heard other people saying before, you know, these are not Nasara. These Christians you see today don't say they're Nasara.
Hmm.
All right, and yet in Quran, you know, Allah does not speak about the Nasara as Muslims.
Mm.
He speaks about them as people who said that Isa is Allah and that Allah is one of three.
Mm.
No, he condemns the Nasara in the Quran. So I guess what you're saying is, you know, there was the original Christians were called Nasara, but
yes.
when they were wiped out and the sellouts took over and corrupted the religion, Allah nevertheless still refers to those people as
yes,
Nasara.
Yes, because there's an evolution. Like I said, up until about the 5th century, right before the messenger comes, they're still worrying about this. You still have re-emerging groups who are saying, one of the guys I like to, Paul Estemus. Let me say this. Are we still recording?
Yeah.
Every decade, I don't know if I go that far, but after every so long, you have a new group of Christians who are coming up saying, this isn't right. You have to reject that. You know, one is Arius. I really like him because he says, during the debate with the Chalcedon Fathers, or not Chalcedon, but Nicaea, he says, it has always been our faith that we believe Jesus to be our prophet and our Messiah, and that we should live our life, this is like the 4th century, and that we should live our lives based on the lifestyle that He has set forth for us to follow, that not to worship Him. He isn't uncreated. He is a created image, and therefore cannot be God. And that's profound. And what I mean to say is that it is correct for what Allah says, that these people, over a period of time, there's a corruption of the religion. It doesn't happen the opposite way, like you find with sociologists who would like to say that there is the evolution of religion. You move from a very primitive religion, and you move, and all of a sudden you have a very advanced form of religion, which I think to most of them, like Buddhism is the most advanced religion, because there's no God, there's no tangible, there's no conscious being anymore. It's the absence of a deity. But that's not the case. What you find is a messenger coming, and the de-evolution of the religion. And along the way, you have like, if you ever seen a machine that monitors the heart, and you see the little blips that go up and down, this is what you have inside of the religion of Avisa. These blips that begin to get smaller and smaller and smaller until it flatlines. And it's interesting is that when we see that flatline take place, that happens right before the coming of the messenger. Let me give you some heads up. Is you find a physical reaction in the earth that takes place. When you have the iconoclast wars, which is the Western Eastern churches are fighting against whether or not they should have they can carve images of Allah. And they say, we're not going to worship them, we're just going to carve them, and that way we can venerate them, we can admire them. When you have, roughly after the end of the time, there is a gentleman who wrote a book called, David Keyes is his name, he writes a book called Catastrophe, and says around this same period, the early 500s, you have a violent eruption or an explosion in the earth that takes place and causes the climate in the entire world to change by at least several degrees. And what happens? The collapse of Tenochtitlan, one of the greatest civilizations inside of the Western hemisphere.
America.
Yes, you have the collapse of that. In the documents we find of the Maya, basically they're saying, they're sacrificing to the gods, to the sun gods, and to their pagan gods to try to bring the rains back, but the rains won't come. You know, no matter how many sacrifices they have, it won't come. The city literally disappears. It looks like almost overnight. You have the destruction of Maghreb Dam in Yemen. I can't remember how to pronounce that. You have it floods. The dam breaks. It impoverishes the Yemeni who were on top of the world for a little time, but who were doing back alley trades with both, Justinian, with the Roman Empire, and with the Sassanid Empire. You have famines all over Europe. Justinian has bankrupted the Roman Empire by engaging in these wars. It looks like an apocalypse. You have the Yemeni and the other Arabs who are flocking to Mecca because it's surviving all of this. Because of its trade with all of these different nations, it has wealth there. And not only that, yes, and not only that, but you have the culture of the Yemeni who are coming. Very specifically, the poetry enters into Mecca and it becomes dominant. Their highest culture, which is their recitation, their poetry, enters into Mecca. And around the same time that all this is happening, this catastrophe is taking place, you have a man, not a god, on the top of a mountain. And his name is Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and we have the religion of Islam. But we'll talk about that in about a month. Inshallah.
Jazakallah khair.